Still, I fulfilled every rule with teeth-clenching determination, until one day during workout, in walked the dazzling nurse who had starred in my erotic fantasies since my stay in the hospital. She sat down quietly and watched our aerial routines. Almost immediately, I noticed everyone in the gym was inspired to a new level of energy. Pretending to be immersed in practice, I glanced at her every now and then out of the corner of my eyes. Her tight silk pants and halter top had snared my concentration. My mind kept drifting off to more exotic forms of gymnastics. For the rest of workout, I was acutely conscious of her attention. She disappeared just before the end of training. I showered, dressed, and headed up the stairs, and there she was, at the top of the staircase, leaning seductively against the banister. I don't even remember walking up the final flight of stairs. "Hi, Dan Millman. I'm Valerie. You look much better than when I cared for you in the hospital." "I am better, Nurse Valerie," I grinned, "and I'm so glad you cared." She laughed and stretched invitingly. "Dan, I wonder if you'd do me a big favor. Would you walk me home? It's getting dark out, and a strange man has been following me." I was about to point out that it was early April and the sun wouldn't be going down for another hour, but then thought, what the hell, a petty detail. We walked, we talked, and I ended up having dinner at her apartment. She opened her bottle of special wine for special occasions. I merely had a sip, but it was the beginning of the end. I was sizzling, hotter than the steak on the grill. There was a moment when a little voice asked, "Are you a man or a jellyfish?" Another little voice answered, "I'm one horny jellyfish." That night, I washed out on every discipline I'd been given. I ate whatever she gave me. I started with a cup of clam chowder, then salad and steak, and for dessert, I had several helpings of Valerie. For the next 3 days, I couldn't sleep very well, preoccupied with how to present my true confession to Socrates. I was prepared for the worst. That night, I walked into the office and told him everything, without apology, and waited, holding my breath. Socrates didn't speak for a long time. Finally, he said, "I noticed you haven't learned to breathe yet." Before I could reply, he held up his hand. "Dan, I can understand how you might choose an ice cream cone or a fling with a pretty woman over the way I have shown you. But can you understand it?" He paused. "No praise, no blame. You now understand the compelling hungers in your belly and your loins." Socrates turned his eyes on bright. They shone through me. "Come back in a month, but only if you've strictly applied the disciplines. See you next month." I knew that if I forgot the disciplines again, it would be the end for me and Socrates. With a growing inner resolve, I said, "I'll master my impulses or die." Valerie called me the next day. I felt all the familiar stirrings at the sound of her voice, which had moaned in my ear not long before. "Danny, I'd love to see you tonight. Are you available?" "Oh, good. I get off work at 7. Shall I meet you at the gym?" "Okay, see you then. Bye." I took her to Joseph's Cafe that night for a supreme salad surprise. I noticed that Valerie was flirting with Joseph. He was his usual warm self, but showed no sign of returning her flirtations. Later, we returned to her apartment. We sat and talked a while. She offered wine. I asked for juice. She touched my hair and kissed me softly, murmuring in my ear. I kissed her back with feeling. Then my inner voice came through loud and clear. "Get yourself together. Remember what you must." I sat up, taking a deep breath. This wasn't going to be easy. She sat up too, straightening herself, patting her hair. "Valerie, you know I find you very attractive and exciting, but I'm involved in some, personal disciplines that no longer allow for what was about to happen. I enjoy your company and want to see you again. But from now on, I suggest you think of me as an intimate friend, a loving priest." I almost couldn't get it out. She took a deep breath and smoothed her hair again. "Dan, it's really good to be with someone who isn't interested only in sex." "Well," I said, encouraged, "I'm glad to hear you feel that way, because I know we can share many things besides a bed." She looked at her watch. "Oh, will you look at the time? And I have to work early tomorrow, too, so I'll say good night, Dan. Thank you for the dinner. It was lovely." I called her the next day, but her phone was busy. I called the following day and finally reached her. "I'm going to be very busy with nursing exams for the next few weeks," she said. I saw her 1 week later when she appeared at the end of practice to meet Scott, one of the other guys on the team. They both walked right past me as I came up the stairs, so close that I could smell her perfume. She nodded politely and said hello. Scott leered back at me and gave me a meaningful wink. I didn't know a wink could hurt so much. With a desperate hunger that a raw salad repast couldn't possibly satisfy, I found myself in front of the charbroiler. I smelled the sizzling hamburgers, basted with special sauce. I remembered all the good times I'd had eating burgers with lettuce and tomatoes and friends. In a daze, I went in without thinking, walked right up to the woman behind the counter and heard myself say, "One charbroiled with double cheese, please." She gave it to me and I sat down, held it to my mouth, and took a huge bite. Suddenly, I realized what I was doing, choosing between Socrates and a cheeseburger. I spit it out, threw it angrily in the trash, and walked out. It was over. I was through being a slave to random impulses. That night marked the beginning of a new glow of self-respect and a feeling of personal power. I knew it would get easier now. Small changes began to add up in my life. Ever since I was a kid, I'd suffered through all kinds of minor symptoms like a runny nose at night when the air cooled, headaches, stomach upsets, and mood swings, all of which I thought were normal and inevitable. Now they'd all vanished. I felt a constant sense of lightness and energy which radiated around me. Maybe that accounted for the number of women flirting with me, the little kids and dogs coming up to me and wanting to play. A few of my teammates started asking for advice about personal problems. No longer a small boat in a stormy sea, I started to feel more like a rock of Gibraltar. I told Socrates about my experience. He nodded. "Your energy level is rising." Then he added, "On the other hand, it would be premature for self-congratulation. To keep your perspective, you'd better compare yourself to me. Then it will be clear that you've only graduated from kindergarten." School ended for the year almost without my noticing it. Exams went smoothly. The studies that had always seemed to be a major struggle for me had become a minor piece of business to get out of the way. The team left for a short vacation, then returned for summer workouts. I was beginning to walk without my cane and even tried to run very slowly a few times a week. I continued pushing myself to the limit of pain, discipline, and endurance, and of course, I continued to do my best with right eating, right moving, and right breathing. But my best was still not very good. Socrates started to increase his demands on me. "Now that your energy is building, you can begin training in earnest," he said. I practiced breathing so slowly that it took 1 minute to complete each breath. When combined with intense concentration and control of specific muscle groups, this breathing exercise heated my body up like a sauna and allowed me to remain comfortable outside, no matter what the temperature. I was excited to realize that I was developing the same power that Sock had shown me on the night we met. For the first time, I began to believe that maybe, just maybe, I could become a warrior of his stature. After feeling left out, I was superior to my friends. A friend complained of illness or other problems that I knew could be simply eating properly. I told him what I'd learned about responsibility and discipline. I took my newfound confidence with me to the station one night, feeling sure that I was about to learn some ancient and arcane secrets of India, Tibet, or China. Instead, as soon as I stepped through the door, I was handed a mop and told to clean the bathroom. "Make those toilets shine." For weeks afterward, I did so many menial tasks around the station that I had no time for my exercises. I lifted tires for 1 hour, then took out the trash, swept the garage, and straightened the tools. I had never imagined it could happen, but being around Socrates was getting boring. At the same time, it was impossibly demanding. He'd give me 5 minutes to do a half-hour job, then criticize me mercilessly if it wasn't done thoroughly. He was unfair, unreasonable, and even insulting. As I was considering my disgust with the state of affairs, Socrates stepped into the garage to tell me that I'd left dirt on the bathroom floor. "But someone used the bathroom after I finished," I said. "No excuses," he said, and added, "throw out the garbage." I was so mad that I gripped my broom handle like a sword. I felt an icy calm. "But I just threw the garbage out 5 minutes ago, Socrates. Do you remember, old man, or are you getting senile?" He grinned. "I'm talking about this garbage, baboon." He tapped his head and winked at me. The broom clattered to the floor. Another evening, when I was sweeping the garage, Socrates called me into his office. I sat down, sullen, waiting for more orders. "Dan, you still haven't learned to breathe naturally. You've been indolent and need to concentrate more." That was the last straw. I screamed at him. "You've been the indolent one. I've been doing all the work for you." He paused, and I actually thought I saw pain in his eyes. Softly, he said, "It isn't proper, Dan, to yell at your teacher." Again, I remembered that the purpose of his insults had always been to show me my own mental and emotional turbulence, to turn my anger to action, and to help me persevere. Before I could apologize, he said, "Dan, you'd better go away and not come back until you have learned courtesy, and until you can breathe properly." Sadly, I shuffled out, my head down. As I walked home, I considered how patient he had been with my tantrums, complaints, and questions. All of his demands had been to serve me. I vowed never to yell at him in anger again. Alone, I tried harder than ever to correct my tense habits of breathing, but it only seemed to get worse. If I breathed deeply, I'd forget to keep my tongue on the roof of my mouth. If I remembered that, I'd slouch over. I was going crazy. In frustration, I went back to the station to see Sock and ask for his advice. I found him tinkering in the garage. He took one look at me and said, "Go away." Angry and hurt, I wordlessly limped off into the night. I heard his voice behind me. "After you learn how to breathe, do something about your sense of humor." His laughter seemed to chase me halfway home. It was almost midsummer when I remembered Joseph's Cafe. I'd been so busy with training in the day and with Sock at night that I hadn't made time to visit him. Now, I thought sadly, my nights were completely free. I walked to Joseph's Cafe just at closing time. The place was empty. I found Joseph in the kitchen lovingly cleaning the fine porcelain dishes. We were so different, Joseph and I. I was short, muscular, athletic, with short hair and a clean-shaven face. Joseph was tall, lean, even fragile-looking, with a soft, curly, blonde beard. I moved and talked quickly. He did everything with slow-motion care. In spite of our differences, or maybe because of them, I was drawn to him. We talked into the night as I helped him stack chairs and sweep the floors. Even as I talked, I concentrated as well as I could on my breathing, which made me drop a dish and trip over the carpet. "Joseph," I asked, "did Socrates really make you go on 100-mile runs?" "No, Dan," he laughed. "My temperament isn't really suited for athletic feats. Didn't Sock tell you? I was his cook and personal attendant for years." "No, he never told me." "But what do you mean that you were his attendant for years? You couldn't be older than 28 or 29. Joseph beamed. "I'm a bit older than that. I'm 52. "Are you serious?" He nodded. There certainly was something to these disciplines. "But if you didn't do very much physical training, what did you do? What was your training?" "Dan, I was a very angry and self-centered young man. By making extremely rigorous demands on me for service, he showed me how to give myself away with real happiness and love." "And what a better place to learn how to serve," I said, "than at a service station." Smiling, Joseph said, "He wasn't always a service station attendant, you know. His life has been extremely unusual and varied." "Tell me about it," I urged. "Hasn't Socrates told you about his past?" "No, he likes to keep it mysterious. I don't even know where he lives." "Not surprising. Well, I'd better keep it mysterious, too, until he wants you to know." "You said he made rigorous demands on you." "Yes, very rigorous. Nothing I did was good enough. And if I had a single negative thought, he always seemed to know and would send me off for weeks. As a matter of fact, I may not ever be able to see him again." "Oh, why so?" "He said I had to stay away until I could breathe properly, relaxed and natural. I've been trying, but I just can't." "Ah, that," he said, putting down the broom. He came over to me and put his hand on my belly and one on my chest. "Now breathe," he said. I started breathing deeply the way Socrates had shown me. "No, don't try so hard," said Joseph. After a few minutes, I started to feel funny in my belly and chest. In that moment, I was breathing completely without effort. It felt like I was being breathed. It felt so pleasurable, I could hardly contain myself. But then I felt the breathing start to tighten again. "Joseph, I lost it." "Don't worry, Dan. You just need to relax a little. I helped you with that. Now you know what natural breathing feels like. To stabilize it, you'll have to let yourself breathe naturally, more and more, until it starts to feel normal." "Joseph," I said, hugging him, "I don't know how you did what you did, but thank you so much." He flashed that smile that made me feel warm all over and, putting the broom away, said, "Give my regards to Socrates." My breathing didn't improve right away. I still struggled, but one afternoon, after an early workout in the gym, pressing weights with my improving leg, I was walking home and noticed that without trying, my breathing was completely natural, close to the way I felt at the cafe. That night, I burst into office, ready to regale Socrates with my success and apologize for my behavior. He looked like he'd been expecting me. As I skidded to a halt in front of him, he said calmly, "Okay, let's continue," as if I just returned from the bathroom rather than 6 weeks intensive training. "Have you nothing else to say, Soc? No, well done, lad, no looking good? Praise and blame are forms of manipulation that you no longer require." I shook my head in exasperation, but at least I was back. When I wasn't cleaning toilets, I was learning new and more frustrating exercises, like meditating on internal sounds until I could hear several at once. One night, as I practiced that exercise, I found myself drawn into a state of peace and relaxation I'd never known before. For a period of time, I don't know for how long, I felt as if I were out of my... This was the first time that my own efforts and energy resulted in a paranormal experience. I hadn't needed Sock's fingers pressing into my head. Excited, I told him about it. Instead of congratulating me, he said, "Dan, don't get distracted by your experiences. Cut through the visions and sounds and see the lessons behind them. They are signs of transformation, but if you don't go beyond them, you never go anywhere. If you want an experience, go see it. It's easier than yoga. Meditate all day if you like. Hear sounds and see lights, or even see sounds and hear lights. You'll still remain a jackass if you become trapped by experience. Let it go. I've suggested that you become a not a vegetable." Frustrated, I said, "I'm only experiencing, as you call it, because you told me to." But he looked at me as if surprised. "Do I have to tell you everything?" About to get furious, I found myself laughing. He laughed too, pointing at me. "Dan, you just transmuted anger to laughter. This means your energy level is much higher than before. Barriers are breaking down. Maybe you're making a little progress, after all." We were still chuckling when he handed me the mop. The following night, for the first time, Socrates was completely silent about my behavior. I got the message. I was going to have to be responsible for watching myself from now on. That's when I realized the kindness in all of his criticisms. I almost missed them. I wasn't aware of it then, nor would I realize it until months later, but that evening Socrates had stopped being my parent and started being my friend. I decided to pay Joseph a visit and tell him what had happened. As I walked down Shattuck, a couple of Fringians wailed by me. I didn't think anything about it until I neared the cafe and saw the orange sky. I began to run. The crowd was already dispersing when I arrived. Joseph had just arrived himself and was standing in front of his charred and gutted cafe. I was still 20 yards away from Joseph when I heard his cry of anguish and saw him drop slowly to his knees and cry. He leaped up with a sense of fury. Then he relaxed. He saw me. "Dan, it's good to see you again." His face was serene. The fire chief came over to him and told him that the fire had probably started in the dry cleaners next door. "Thank you," Joseph said. "Oh, Joseph, I'm so sorry." Then my curiosity surfaced. "Joseph, I saw you a minute ago. You were very upset." He smiled. "Yes, I felt very upset, so I really let it out." I remembered Sock's words, "Let it flow and let it go." Until now, it had just been a nice idea, but here, before the blackened, waterlogged remains of his beautiful cafe, this fragile warrior had actually demonstrated complete mastery of his emotions. "Ah, it was such a beautiful place, Joseph," I sighed, shaking my head. "Yes," he said wistfully, "wasn't it?" For some reason, his calm now bothered me. "Aren't you upset now at all?" He looked at me dispassionately, then said, "I have a story you might enjoy, Dan. Want to hear it?" "Well, okay." In a small fishing village in Japan, there lived a young, unmarried woman who gave birth to a child. Her parents felt disgraced and demanded to know the identity of the father. Afraid, she refused to tell them. The fisherman she loved had told her secretly that he was going off to seek his fortune and would return to marry her. Her parents persisted. In desperation, she named Hakuin, a monk who lived in the hills, as the father. Outraged, the parents took the infant girl out of his door, pounded until he opened it, and handed him the baby, saying, "This child is yours. You must care for it." "Is that so?" Hakuin said, taking the child in his arms, waved goodbye to the parents. A year passed, and the real father returned to marry the young woman. At once they went to Hakuin to beg for the return of their child. We must have our daughter, they said. Is that so? Said Hyde, handing the child to them. Joseph smiled and waited for my response. An interesting story, Joseph, but I don't understand why you're telling it to me now. Your cafe just burned down. Is that so? He said. Then we laughed, shook my head in resignation. Joseph, you're as crazy as Socrates. Why, thank you, Dan. And you're upset enough for both of us. Don't worry about me, though. I've been ready for a change. I'll probably move south or north. It makes no difference. Well, don't go without saying goodbye. Goodbye, then, he said, giving me one of his hugs that left me glowing. I'll be leaving tomorrow. Are you going to say goodbye to Socrates? He laughed, replying, Socrates and I rarely say hello or goodbye. You'll understand later. With that, it was the last time I would see Joseph. About 3 a.m. Friday morning, I passed the clock at Shattuck and Center on the way to the gas station. I was more aware than ever of how much I still had to learn. I stepped into the office already talking. Socks, Joseph's cafe burned down tonight. Strange, he said. Cafes usually burn up. I couldn't believe it. He was making jokes. Anyone hurt, he asked Kelly, without apparent concern. Not that I know of. Did you hear me? Aren't you even a little bit upset? Was Joseph upset when you spoke with him? No. All right, then. And that topic was simply closed. Then, to my amazement, Socrates took out a pack of cigarettes and lit one. Speaking of smoking, I mentioned to you that there's no such thing as a bad habit. I couldn't believe my eyes or my ears. This isn't happening, I told myself. No, you didn't, and I've gone to great lengths on your recommendation to change my habits. Oh, that was to develop your will, you see, and to give your instincts a refresher course. And we can say that habit itself, unconscious compulsive ritual, but specifics, smoking, drinking, drugs, eating sweets, or asking silly questions, are bad and good. Every action has its price and its pleasures. Recognizing both sides, you become realistic and responsible for your actions. And only then can you make the warrior's free choice to do or not to do. There is a saying, when you sit, sit. When you stand, stand. Whatever you do, don't wobble. Once you make your choice, do it with all your spirit. Don't be like the evangelist who thought about praying while making love to his wife, and making love to his wife while praying. I laughed at this image while Socrates blew perfect smoke rings. It's better to make a mistake with the full force of your being than to carefully avoid mistakes with a trembling spirit. Responsibility means recognizing both pleasure and price, making a choice based on that recognition, and then living with that choice without concern. Sock, I still think smoking is disgusting. Haven't I got the message across to you yet, Junior? Smoking is not disgusting. The habit is. I may smoke one cigarette a day, then not smoke one for 6 months. I may enjoy one cigarette a day or one a week without any unmanageable urges to have another. And when I do smoke, I don't pretend that my lungs won't pay a price. I follow appropriate action afterward to help counterbalance the negative effects. I just never imagined a warrior would smoke. He blew smoke rings at my nose. I never said that a warrior behaved in a way that you considered perfect, nor do all warriors act exactly as I do. But we all follow the house rules, you see. So whether or not my behavior meets your new standards or not, it should be clear to you that I have mastered all compulsions, all behavior. I have no habits. My actions are conscious, intentional, and complete. Socrates put out his cigarette, smiling. You've become too stuffy with all your pride and superior discipline. It's time we did a little celebrating. Then Socrates pulled out a bottle of gin from his desk. I just sat in disbelief, shaking my head. He mixed me a drink with gin and soda pop. Soda pop, I asked? We only have fruit juice here, and don't call me Pop, he said, reminding me of the words he'd spoken to me so long ago. Now here he was, offering me a gin and ginger ale, drinking his straight. So, he said, drinking the gin quickly, time to party, no holds barred. I like your enthusiasm, Sock, but I have a hard workout on Monday. Get your coat, Sonny, and follow me. I did. The only thing I remember clearly is that it was Saturday night in San Francisco. We started early and never stopped moving. The evening was a blur of lights, tinkling voices, and laughter. I do remember Sunday morning. It was about 5 o'clock. My head was throbbing. We were walking down Mission, crossing 4th Street. I could barely see the street signs through the thick early morning fog that had rolled in. Suddenly, Simon stared into the fog. I stumbled into him, giggled, then woke up quickly. Something was wrong. A large, dark shape emerged from the mist. My half-forgotten dreams flashed into my mind, vanished as I saw another shape, then a third. Three men. Two of them, tall, lean, tense, blocked our way. The third approached us and drew a stiletto from his worn leather jacket. I pulsed pounding through my temples. "Give me your money," he commanded. Not thinking clearly, I stepped toward him, reaching for my wallet, and stumbled forward. He was startled and rushed toward me, slashing with his knife. Socrates, moving faster than ever seen before, caught the man's wrist, whirled around, and threw him into the street, just as another thug lunged for me. He never touched me. Socrates had kicked his legs out from under him with a lightning leg sweep. Before the third attacker could even move, Sock was upon him, taking him down with a wrist lock and a sweeping motion of his arm. One of the men started to get up when Socrates let out a powerful shout, and the man fell backward. But then the leader himself out of the street, found his knife, and was limping furiously toward Socrates. Sock stood up, lifted the man he'd been sitting on, and threw him toward the knife man, yelling. They tumbled to the concrete. Then, in a wild rage, all three came screaming at us in a last, desperate assault. The next few minutes were blurred. I remember being pushed by Socrates and falling. Then it was quiet, except for a moan. Socrates stood still, then shook his arms loose and took a deep breath. He threw the knives into the sewer. Then he turned to me. "You okay?"
"Except for my head."
"You get hit?"
"Only by alcohol. What happened?"
He turned to the three men stretched out on the pavement, knelt and felt their pulses. Turning them over almost tenderly, he gave gentle prodding motions, checking them for injuries. Only then did I realize he was doing his best to heal them. "Call a police ambulance," he said, turning to me. I ran to a nearby phone booth and called. Then we left them and walked quickly to the bus station. I looked at Socrates. There were faint tears in his eyes, and for the first time since I'd known him, he looked pale and very tired. We spoke little on the bus ride home. That was fine with me. Talking hurt too much. When the bus stopped at University in Shattuck, Socrates got off and said, "You're invited to my office next Wednesday for a few drinks." Smiling at my pained expression, he continued, "Of herb tea." I got off the bus a block from home. My head was ready to explode. I felt like we'd lost the fight, and they were still beating on my head. I tried to keep my eyes closed as much as possible, walking the last block to the apartment house. "So this is what it feels like to be a vampire," I thought. "Sunlight can kill." Our celebration, steeped in an alcoholic haze, had taught me two things. First, I had needed to loosen up and let loose. Second, I was making a responsible choice. No more drinking. It wasn't worth the price. Besides, its pleasure was insignificant compared to what I was beginning to enjoy. Monday's gymnastics workout, the best in many months, made me more determined that I would again become physically and spiritually whole. My leg was healing better than I'd had any right to expect. I had been taken under the wing of an extraordinary man. Walking home, I was so overwhelmed with gratitude that I knelt outside my apartment and touched the earth. Taking a handful of dirt in my hand, I gazed up through the emerald leaves shimmering in the breeze. For a few precious seconds, I seemed to slowly melt into the earth. Then, for the first time since I was a tiny child, I felt a life-giving presence without a name. Just then my analytical mind piped in, "Ah, so this is a spontaneous mystical experience," and the spell was broken. I returned to my earthly predicament. I was an ordinary man again, standing under an elm tree, holding dirt in his hand. I entered my apartment in a relaxed daze, read for a while, and fell asleep. Tuesday was a day of quiet, the quiet before the storm. Wednesday morning, I plunged into the mainstream of classes. My feelings of serenity, which I thought were permanent, soon gave way to subtle anxieties and old urges. After all my discipline training, I was profoundly disappointed. Then, something new happened. I felt the awakening of a powerful intuitive wisdom that could be translated into words. Old urges will continue to arise, perhaps for years. Urges do not matter. Actions do. At first, I thought my mind was playing tricks on me.
But it wasn't a thought. It wasn't a voice. It was a feeling certainty. I felt like Socrates was inside me, a warrior within. This feeling was to remain with me. That evening, I went to the station to tell Socrates about my mind's recent hyperactivity and about the feeling. I found him replacing a generator in a battered Mercury. He looked up, greeted me, and said casually, "Joseph died this morning." I fell back against the station wagon behind me, sick at the news of Joseph's death and Sock's apparent callousness. Finally, I was able to speak. "How did he die?" "Oh, very well, I imagine," Socrates smiled. "He had leukemia, you see. Joseph had been ill for a number of years. He hung in there for a long time. Fine warrior, that one." He spoke with affection, but almost casually, without a trace of sorrow. "Socrates, aren't you upset just a little?" He laid the wrench down. "There's no cause for unhappiness." "But Socrates, he's gone." Sock laughed softly. "Perhaps he's gone, perhaps not. Maybe he was never here." His laughter through the garage. "I want to understand you, but I can't. How can you be so casual about death? Will you point if I die?" "Of course," he laughed. "Dan, there are things you don't understand yet. For now, I can only say that death is a transformation. Perhaps a bit more radical than puberty," he smiled, "but nothing to be particularly upset about. It's one of the body's changes. When it happens, it happens. The warrior neither seeks death nor flees from it." His face grew more somber before he spoke again. "Death is not sad. The sad thing is that most people don't ever really live at all." Then his eyes filled with tears. We sat, two friends, in silence, before I walked home. I had just turned down a side street when the feeling came again. Tragedy is very different for the warrior and for the fool. Socrates hadn't been sad because he simply didn't consider Joseph's death a tragedy. I wasn't to realize why that was so until a long time later, deep within a mountain cave. Still, I couldn't shake the belief I, and therefore Socrates, was supposed to be miserable when death struck. With that confusion ringing in my mind, I finally fell asleep. In the morning, I had my answer. Socrates had simply not met my expectations. I was filled with a new resolve. I had seen the futility of trying to live up to the conditioned expectation of others or of my own mind. I would, like the warrior, choose when, where, and how I would act. With that decision, I felt I had begun to understand the life of a warrior. That night, I walked into the station office and said to Socrates, "I'm ready. Nothing can stop me now." His fierce stare undid all my months of training. I quivered. He whispered, yet his voice seemed piercing, "Do not be so flippant. Perhaps you are ready, perhaps not. One thing is for certain. You don't have much time left. Each day that passes is one day closer to your death. We are not playing games here. Do you understand that?" I thought I heard the wind begin to howl outside. Without warning, I felt his warm fingers touch my temple. I was crouched in the brush. 10 feet away, facing my hiding place, was a swordsman over 7 feet tall. His massive, muscular body reeked of sulfur. His head, even his forehead, was covered by ugly, matted hair. His eyebrows were huge slashes on a hateful, twisted face. He stared malevolently at a young swordsman who faced him. 5 identical images of the giant materialized and encircled the young swordsman. All 6 of them laughed at once, a groaning, growling laugh deep in their bellies. I felt sick. The young warrior jerked his head right and left, swinging his sword frantically, whirling, dodging, and cutting through the air. He didn't have a chance. With a roar, all the images leaped toward him. Behind him, the giant's sword cut downward, hacking off his arm. He screamed in pain as the blood spurted and slashed blindly through the air in a last frenzied effort. The huge sword sliced again, and the young swordsman's head fell from his shoulder to the earth, a shock expression on his face. "Ah!" I groaned involuntarily, nausea washing over me. The stink of sulfur overwhelmed me. A painful grip on arm tore me from the bushes, flung me to the ground. When I opened my eyes, the dead eyes of the young swordsman's severed head, inches away from my face, silently warned me of my own impending doom. Then I heard the guttural voice of the giant. "Say farewell to life, young fool," and growled. "Hear me, and I dove the warrior's sword and rolled to my feet, facing him. "I call the fool by far better, you slobbering eunuch!" scream I attacked, swift. The force parry knocked me off my feet. Suddenly there were six of him. I tried to keep original as I leaped to my feet, no longer sure. They began to chant, their belly. It became a low-pitched, horrible death rattle as they crept slowly toward me. And the feeling came to me that I had to do. The giant represents the source of all your woes. He is your mind. He is the demon you must cut through. Don't be deluded like the fallen warrior. Keep your focus. Absurdly, my mind commented, "One hell of a time for a lesson." Then I was back to my immediate predicament, feeling an icy calm. I lay down on my back and closed my eyes as if surrendering to my fate, the sword in my hands, its blade across my chest and cheek. The illusions could fool my eyes, but not my ears. Only the real swordsman would make a sound as he walked. I heard him behind me. He had only two choices, to walk away or to kill. He chose to kill. I listened intently. Just as I sensed his sword about to cut downward, I drove my blade upward with all my might and felt it pierce, tearing upward through cloth, flesh, and muscle. A terrible scream, and I heard the thud of his body. Face down, impaled on my sword, was the demon. "You almost didn't come back that time," said Socrates. I ran to the bathroom, where I was immediately thoroughly sick. When I came out, he had made some chamomile tea with licorice for the stomach. "Tell Socrates about the journey," when he interrupted me. "I was bush behind you watching the whole thing. I nearly sneezed once. You're glad I didn't." "I certainly wasn't anxious to tangle with that character. For a moment I thought I was going to have it. You handled yourself pretty well, Dan." "Why, thanks, Soc," I beamed. On the other hand, you seem to have missed the point that nearly cost you your life." Now it was my turn to interrupt. "The main point I was concerned with was the end of that giant's blade," I joked, "and I didn't miss the point."
"Is that so?"
"Soc, I've been battling illusions my whole life, preoccupied with every petty personal them. I've dedicated my life to self-improvement without grasping the one problem that sent me seeking in the first place. While trying to make everything in the world work out for me, I always succumbed to my own mind, always preoccupied with me, me, me. The giant is my only real problem in life. It's my mind." "And Socrates," I said with growing excitement, just realizing what I'd done, "I cut through it."
"There was no doubt about that," he said.
"Sock, what would have happened if the giant had won? What then?"
"Don't talk of such things," he said darkly.
"I want to know. Would I have really died?"
"Very likely," he said. "At the very least, you would have gone mad." Just then, the tea kettle began to shriek.
Chapter 5: The Mountain Path. Socrates poured steaming hot tea into our twin mugs and spoke the first encouraging words I'd heard in many months. "You're ready to progress further toward the one goal."
"What's that?"
"When you discover that, you'll already be there. In the meantime, your training can now move to a different arena." A change, a sign of progress. I was getting excited. Finally, we're going to get moving again, I thought. "Socrates," I asked, "what different arena are you referring to?" "For one thing, I'm no longer going to be an answer machine. You're going to have to find the answers from within. And you begin now. Go out back, behind the station, behind the trash bin. There, in the very corner of the lot, against the wall, you'll find a large, flat stone. Sit on that stone until you have something of value to tell me." I paused.
"That's all?"
"That's it. Sit and open your mind to your own wisdom." I went outside, found the rock, and sat in the darkness. First, random thoughts drifted through my mind. Then I thought of all the important concepts I'd learned in my years at school. An hour went by, then two, then three. The sun would rise in another few hours, and I was getting cold. I began to slow my breathing and to vividly imagine my belly as warm. Before long, I felt comfortable again. Dawn came. The only thing that I could think of to tell him was a realization I'd had during a psychology lecture. I got up on stiff, sore legs and hobbled into the office. Socrates, looking relaxed and comfortable at his desk, said, "Ah, so soon? Well, what is it?" I was almost embarrassed to say it, but hoped he'd be satisfied. "Okay, Soc, beneath all our apparent differences, we all share the same human needs and fears.
We're all on the same path together, guiding one another, and that understanding can give us compassion. Not bad, he said. Back to the rock. But it's going to be dawn. You're leaving. That's no problem, he grinned. I'm sure you'll have thought of something by tonight. Tonight, He pointed to the door. Sitting on the rock, my whole body aching, I thought back to my childhood. I considered my past, searching for insights. I tried to compress all that had transpired in the months with Socrates into a witty aphorism. I thought of the classes I was missing and the gymnastics workouts I'd have to miss, and the excuse I'd give the coach. Maybe I'd tell him I had been sitting on a rock in a gas station. That would be a crazy enough story to make him laugh. The sun crept with agonizing slowness across the sky. I sat hungry, irritated, then depressed as darkness fell. I had nothing for Socrates. Then, about the time he was due in, it came to me. He wanted something deep, something more cosmic. I concentrated with renewed effort. I saw him walk into the office, waving to me. I redoubled my efforts. Then, about midnight, I had it. I couldn't even walk, so I stretched for a few minutes before shuffling into the office. I've seen beneath people's social masks to their common fears and troubled minds, and that has made me cynical, because I haven't yet been able to get beyond all that to see the light within them. I figured that was a revelation of major proportions. Excellent, Sock announced. Just as I started to sigh, he added, but not quite what I had in mind. Can you bring me something more moving? I roared with anger at no one in particular and stomped out to my philosopher's stone. Something more moving, he had said. Was that a hint? I naturally thought back to my recent workouts in the gymnastics room. My teammates now clucked about me like mother hens. Recently I was doing giant swings around the high bar, missing a pirouette change, and had to jump off from the top of the bar. I knew I was going to land on my feet pretty hard, but before I even hit the ground, Sid Herb caught me in midair and set me down gently. Be careful, Dan, Sid scolded. You want to snap your leg before it heals? None of that seemed very relevant to my present situation, but I let my awareness relax, hoping that maybe the feeling would advise me. Nothing. I was getting so stiff and sore I couldn't concentrate anymore. I didn't think it would be cheating to stand on the rock and practice a few flowing movements of Tai Chi, the Chinese form of slow-motion exercise that Sock had shown me. As I bent my knees and gracefully rocked back and forth, my hips turning and arms floating in the air, I let my breath control the shifting of my weight. My mind emptied, then filled with the scene. A few days before, I had jogged slowly and carefully to Provo Square in the middle of Berkeley, across from City Hall and directly adjacent to Berkeley High School. To help relax, I began swaying back and forth in the movements of Tai Chi. I concentrated on softness and balance, feeling like seaweed floating in the ocean. A few boys and girls from the high school stopped and watched me, but I paid them no attention, letting my concentration flow with the movements. When I finished and walked over to put my sweatpants back on over my running shorts, my ordinary awareness reasserted itself. I wonder if I looked good, I thought. My attention was then captured by two pretty teenagers who were watching me and giggling. I guess those girls were impressed, I thought, as I put both legs into one pant leg, lost my balance, and fell on my ass. A few other students joined the girls in their laughter. I felt embarrassed for a moment, but then lay back and laughed with them. I wondered, still standing on the rock, why that incident could be important. Then it hit me. I knew I had something of value to tell Socrates. I walked into the office, stood before Sock's desk, and said, "There are no ordinary moments." Sock smiled. "Welcome back." I collapsed on the couch, and he made tea.